When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There were moments that stood out for me that I remember reading them and thinking, I want to do this. There's a lovely thing in this movie where I take the kid ice skating. That's my favorite thing in the movie. And it's inarticulate. And there's no words ever spoken. And I remembered reading it and thinking, that to me somehow is the heart of this thing. And I want to just do that. I want to do that part. I want to have that thing to do.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Awardist, where we are chatting with the actors, creators, and more who are contenders this year and breaking down the state of the 2024 Oscars race. I'm Entertainment Weekly executive editor Jared Hall, and joining me this week, she's back, EW writer Lauren Huff. Hey, Lauren, how are you?
Hello. Hi, Jared. I'm good. How are you?
I'm great, actually. I'm taking a look at the calendar and realizing, like, we're less than a month away from the Oscars. We've had the Oscar nominees luncheon earlier this week, which I will share a bit about shortly here. And winter is just trekking along. How about you?
Yes, I know. I can't believe. I feel like every year we gear up for this big, massive award season, and then the end always just comes so quickly. And here we are. We're almost at the end.
Well, you know, January of this year felt like 4 years on its own, and
yes,
somehow we're already in mid-February, which I have zero explanation for. But
I blame the Emmys.
Here we are.
I blame the Emmys.
You know,
it's all their fault.
That extra award show in the midst of everything. You might be onto something with that. It certainly added on to everything, no doubt. So before we get into the nitty-gritty of our conversation here, I want to let everyone know who our big guest is on today's show. Fresh off that Oscar nominees luncheon that I mentioned, it's my chat with the Holdovers star and best actor nominee, Paul Giamatti, who is just so gosh darn lovely and a wonderful guy. I really enjoyed my conversation with him. Lauren, what is your, I was going to say hot take, but I'm sure it's actually a very thoughtful take on Paul and that film.
It is definitely not a hot take for you. It's a very cold take, or maybe warm is a better word for it, because it's just lovely. I adore everything that Paul Giamatti does, and I loved him in The Holdovers, and I'm so glad that this year feels like he's finally getting his flowers. You know, I think he's someone in the industry that everybody, you know, speaks highly of and enjoys working with, and he just puts in consistently great work. And so it's just lovely to see that coming to fruition here. And I love The Holdovers personally. That was one of my favorite films of the year for sure. So I'm so glad that he is our special guest today.
Yes.
And that you got to speak with him. I'm jealous.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's great, I shared with him as much, you know, that this was a film when I saw it that I went in, I had no idea what to expect from this thing, and from minute one to the end, it's like a 2-hour, 13-minute runtime, I was just captivated the entire time by these characters, but also the performances of Paul, along with Davine Joy Randolph and Dominic Sessa, who this kind of unlikely Three Musketeers trio, if you will, whatever analogy you want to compare them to. I just love them together so much, and I think they all really brought out the best in each other. And you know, you love to see that when it happens, and when it's captured on film like that.
When did you see the film?
Oh gosh, Lauren, I think I first saw it. Would it have been right before Toronto Film Festival, I believe?
Yeah, so early.
Early. And then saw it a second time. Would have been probably November once the strikes were over, because I was wanted to see it again to prepare for my interview with Dave Eyme. It's just such a pleasant watch, and it's one that I can watch over and over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, and I can't say that sometimes. About awards movies. Often.
No,
that was
no,
my
not
first
at all.
Takeaway too. Whenever I watched it with my husband over the holidays, actually, and that was something
perfect
that we talked
time to
about.
Watch.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was like, this feels like a great little holiday movie to add into the rotation. I didn't expect that going into it at all. Since I saw it later, the reason why I asked when you saw it is since I saw it later in the season. You know, I kind of had already heard a bunch of buzz and whatever. So I went in with, mm-hmm. I think, different expectations than you probably did. And it still just blew me away. I don't know what I was quite expecting, but it was everything and more than I went in expecting.
Yeah, that's so true. Because sometimes a lot of chatter will raise expectations, or you just mm-hmm. have a certain idea of what you're getting. And it can certainly change the experience. All of that said, this is a film that, you know, I think a lot of people in the industry, and by in the industry, I do mean voters, there is a soft spot in their hearts for this film. And a lot of pundits have it in second place. Do you think this film should very seriously be considered a dark horse and could walk away with the win? Or is it like, for you, foregone conclusion, it's Oppenheimer Best Picture?
So it's funny that you ask that. The second thing after I mentioned that it was a great holiday movie, the second thing I told my husband was, I think that this is a dark horse for sure.
Oh.
It's everything I've heard about it from screenings and the industry and whatnot is it always gets a great reaction. It's been very, very well received. And I think it's the type of film that, well, it got all the key nominations that I'm always looking out for. In particular, editing. That's one that always makes my little hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Uh-huh. Anytime those films overlap with Best Picture, I'm like, well, and it's got acting, too, specifically, of course, for Paul and Dave Eyme. And screenplay. These are all really, really key nominations. And so I think that speaks to a lot of support. And it's also just the type of film that, like, it's got that heartwarming element that, again, a lot of times awards movies don't often have. And we've seen time and time again that those types of movies sort of slip up the middle sometimes.
Yeah, Coda.
So I think that if it's not Oppenheimer, it's The Holdovers. That would be my honest assessment.
Yeah, the one thing that you mentioned all those key categories. The one thing it lacks is director. Alexander Payne did not get in for his direction, and I think it's a real shame because there's such a. He put such a mark on this, the way he stylized the film, the way he shot it, the way it is a movie set in the 70s that feels like it was released in the 70s. And it's just, I think, such a beautiful touch to the film. If it had felt modern, I'm not sure it would have the same kind of oomph to it. And
Agreed.
Oomph is a very technical film term,
We love technical terms. Yes. I agree completely. And that's the only thing that kind of gives me pause. But I mean, you could see a Christopher Nolan Best Director and Best Picture split. I mean, we see
that
it.
That is true.
We've seen it a lot since the preferential ballot came into play.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean, look, Ben Affleck was not nominated for Argo. So he did not win directing, but it did win Best Picture. So look, it's not out of question, at all that is something that could happen. And that could certainly make things exciting come Oscar night, which I do want to get into that with you a little bit later, but let's pause for a second to talk more about the Oscar nominees luncheon that I mentioned. That was on Monday this week. The second year I've been, and it's just such a, it's one thing to go to these award shows, and it's such an honor to be able to like sit in this room where you grow up watching award shows, and you're like, it feels so distant and not anything that you could ever imagine being at, but then. you know, when you're a little kid growing up in Indiana, you don't know that there's a thing called this Oscar nominees luncheon until, you know, you get to LA and you, mm-hmm. you know, you start to hear about these things. And you're like, oh, well, that's really cool because they take a class photo and all this stuff. So my second year at that, and it is truly a pinch me moment. And you're just kind of standing there scanning the room like, wow, it's, you know, all of your favorites and people who you admire so much, you know, from the art that they have given us over the years. This year, a few observations that I want to share, and I put this on my social media, and a lot of people did, because the real star of this event, yeah, the real star of this event, Lauren, was not a human, but it in fact was a canine, the dog from Anatomy of a Fall, Snoop, real name, Messy. This dog, just such a beautiful, kind, gentle soul, and was letting everyone take pictures and pet him. And he had a little plush toy bone that was, you know, that was really the thing. If you wanted to get a picture, you held that and he was looking right at that, and you got yourself a, you know, the perfect eye line for your picture and everything. I think he might have been a little tired. You know, he did make the trip from France. And, you know, they were doing a few events this week around LA in support of that film that he will be attending. So, but yeah, Lauren, I mean, when I tell you, like, America Ferrera, oh, she saw him and came right up and she was squatted down right there on his level. Emma Stone, I saw her. She was standing near, but I don't know if I ever saw her go up to him, but she was right by him talking to Ryan Gosling and was looking over and was like, oh my God, it's the dog. Like, the dog's here. Yeah. So,
and Ryan Gosling was like clutching his chest. I saw videos.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly me.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So I was at the table basically next to his, so very, very close. And the way this luncheon operates, there's an introduction. Well, there's a little cocktail reception first, but once you get to your seats and everything, the Academy president welcomes everyone, and then lunch is served. But basically, as soon as lunch is served, people get up from their seats and they start mingling. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately, Emily Blunt was over to Ryan, her co-star in The Fall Guy. That one's coming up in a couple months, which they're so great together in. A lot of people coming up to Ryan Gosling. I saw him speaking with Billie Eilish and Phineas. He was over near Greta Gerwig's table at one point talking. All of that to say, I feel like, aside from Snoop, and, you know, the dog getting all the attention, I feel like a lot of people were gravitating toward Ryan, which I found really interesting in
There's
the bigger picture.
There's always at least one.
Yeah.
My year, it was Brad Pitt. It was Brad Pitt.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Was that for the year he won?
Yeah, it was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the year of Parasite, the year of 1917. It was a good year, although you had the dog, so I don't know. I think this year's luncheon is the luncheon to end all luncheons.
Well, yeah, they'll have to really one-up themselves next year, bring in more animals. But see, that's what I find so interesting, though, is as you feel people gravitating towards certain people, does it mean something for how things may go, or is it just, you know, people want to talk to Ken?
I think, yeah. I mean, in the case of this year, I think it's just like, I want to talk to Ryan Gosling. But of course, you know, like I said, I mean, at my year, it was Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt did in fact win. Right. I think a lot of people pay attention to the applause that people get as they get called up. And I will say my year, the big applause was for Parasite. In particular, director Bong Joon-ho. So, you know, I mean, every year people point those things out, and it's not always indicative. Sometimes it's just like, we really love this person, and a lot of us have worked with that person, and you know. But yeah, I don't know, that is interesting. I think Ryan's just, I mean, who hasn't Ryan worked with at this point, and who doesn't love?
That's true.
Ken.
yeah, that is true. So. I did even notice as they were getting everyone settled on the you know, the risers to take their class photo, that at one point he was more kind of like top middle, but then, you know, the people who are helping set everything up, they then also they moved him to the back left, and then Emma Stone then was near him on the left, and then they even kind of swapped with people, so they were a little bit closer. You know, you see a little bit of that going on, but you know, now you have me thinking, wondering who, you know, the biggest applause. There was certainly a lot for Ryan. There was a lot for Greta Gerwig. Rightfully so. You know, I think in some regards, yes, she had the biggest movie of the year, but there was also, of course, she did not get a director nomination. So I think you might get a, you know, there, that might factor in as well. Like, oh, we love you. We can't believe you didn't get nominated.
I think there was someone that year, my year too, where it was somebody that was a part of a film.
Yeah.
So they were there for, you know, whatever reason, but they weren't actually nominated. And there was a bit of a snub narrative there.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
definitely could be some of that there.
Yeah. Yeah. So looking back, I really kind of think Greta maybe, you know, on the applause meter won that. And then until though the very end, the, you know, the last person announced, last but not least, as he was introduced, Robert Downey Jr., who, you know,
but are they applauding because it's done?
Well, that is a great point. That is a great point. But he was very Robert Downey Jr. about it and hammed it up. And, you know, he got up there and took his rightful place to, you know, get in on that picture. So yes, you know, you bring up a good point. We've arrived at the end, but oh, hey, it is also, it's Robert Downey Jr. and we love him. And, you know, so there was a lot of that going on.
I mean, what a person to save for last. I think they knew what they were doing there.
I think they did too. I suspect you might be right about that. Okay. So the question I put on hold a little earlier, talking about, you know, we would love to see some surprises come Oscar night. That is the question I posed to you. Who would you love to see surprise and shock everyone with a win on March 10th?
I think my answer is going to surprise you, because it's not in a traditional, you know, one of the big five above the line type of categories. But I think it's kind of a foregone conclusion that Zone of Interest is going to get Best International. And I would like to see Society of the Snow surprise there instead.
I am so happy to hear
too,
you bring that up.
That's also where it's nominated. So I would love to see it in either of those, but I don't know that it's currently being predicted to do so, but that would be my pick because that film just has really stuck with me in a way that a lot of films just don't. I thought it spoke to the human spirit that film just bowled me over. So I would, not that Zone of Interest isn't, of course, a wonderful film in its own right, but that would be my personal pick. Are you surprised?
I was surprised to hear you say that, but I'm thrilled to hear you say that. I loved that movie so much. For those who don't know, who have not seen it, it is about the, I believe it was 1972 plane crash of a group of, they were rugby players, right? No. Athletes. A group of athletes on a plane flying from, flying to Argentina. They crashed in the Andes Mountain near the Argentina-Chile border. And many of them died in the accident, but many also survived. And so it really becomes about how do they continue to survive? And what is so beautiful about the story, you know, we have shows and we've seen movies where it becomes very survivalist and people turn on each other. And that is not this film. It's really about honoring each other's lives, honoring the ones who have died, honoring the ones who are still alive, knowing that some of them are not going to make it. And those people essentially making a very hard decision to, you know, essentially give each other permission to use their bodies as they need to for survival. And it's hard to watch it sometimes, not as hard to watch as Zone of Interest at times. But
which
I just thought they,
something.
Yeah, but I think it's just a beautiful film. The director, J.A. Bayona, who also did The Impossible. So he knows a thing or two about some disaster films. I think he did a wonderful job. Yes. And disaster of a different kind.
Dinosaur disaster.
Yeah. I love that film.
No, it's, you put it perfectly. I tend to have some negative opinions about Mankind, but that movie reminded me, a reminder I really needed that it's not all bad, and people can do amazing, incredible things. And it really spoke to the human spirit and the triumph of the human spirit. And I cried so hard. I'm sitting here tearing up just even thinking about it.
Right. I wasn't expecting it. Yeah. Film. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what you said. The human spirit, that like take care of each other is really what it was. It's we don't have to turn on each other. We take care of each other.
Well, and these people, a lot of them didn't know each other. That's what's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I think we think that they were all part of this team and whatever, but a lot of the people were just regular people on a flight that ended terribly and were stuck in this position with a bunch of people that they had never, or they barely knew, if they knew them at all.
Right,
it's just wild. But what were your surprises? I'm sure you've got a few that you would like to see win on Oscar Sunday.
Oh, I hadn't prepared my own answer for this, but I would
you were
say,
just going to grill me about it, huh?
I was. You got me. Well, the ones that I'm thinking about, you know, I think where it does get interesting is in the screenplay categories as well. Mm. I would love to see Celine Song win.
Mm.
Yeah, for Past Lives, for her screenplay. And I don't necessarily know either. I've seen some people picking her, but by and large, it feels like a couple of the screenplay, because so adapted, really, it feels like it's between Oppenheimer and Barbie. We've got a Barbenheimer race there for that one. Barbie tried to go for original screenplay because it is a completely original story based on existing character IP. It's such a weird, tricky, like...
So...
Yeah,
there's always some funky things going on in screenplay that are just like that. I believe it was the lovely gentleman behind the Lego movie.
Phil Lord, Chris Miller.
Yes, thank you, Lord and Miller. I just like had a brain fart there. They're some of my favorites, so I'm super embarrassed that I forgot their names momentarily. Anyways, they spoke out about it. I think don't quote me on that, but I think I remember seeing some tweets about like it's how is this different than like the Lego movie, which is obviously a completely original thing. It just happens to be based on a toy.
Yeah.
How are you going to say that's really adapted? I mean, come on. Anyways.
I know. Yeah. It's these little, like it's the fine details of the rules. And I think this one ultimately came down to it. They had to have a, you know, internally, the awards folks at the Academy had to decide where it would go. But yeah, looking at original screenplay, I mean, the others are Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Maestro, May, December. Oh, man. I mean,
some
Anatomy
really
of
good
a Fall. Yeah. One of my favorites of the year, The Holdovers and Past Lives. Those three just, holy cow.
I feel like it'll be The Holdovers.
I think it might be.
I would be happy with just about any of these.
I know, honestly. Yeah. Same. You know, the film I would love to see win animated feature is Nimona.
Oh, interesting.
I liked that movie so much. That one is just one of my favorites of last year as well. I feel like it didn't really get as much. I think it certainly got attention. There was a lot of press around the film and everything, but I thought maybe more audiences would have been talking about it.
No, that's a good one. That's a good pick, because I feel like that category is also kind of usually it's pretty clear what's going to win that going into Oscar night.
Right.
I feel like
I feel like a front runner has emerged with The Boy and the Heron, but we'll see. Sometimes animated is where there are surprises. So
I mean, I think Spider-Man has a good shot as well.
Yes,
if I had to pick a
I agree with you. I think it really is between the two of those, because it's kind of gone back and forth at various ceremonies. So,
right,
time will tell. The days are ticking away until March 10th. So how about this? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to get to that interview with Paul Giamatti. So don't go anywhere, folks. The Awardist will be right back. Thank you. Welcome back to The Awardist. He is a previous nominee for Cinderella Man. A lot of people think that he wasn't nominated for Sideways, one of that year's really big snubs. But this year, Paul Giamatti is not just a nominee, but he is perhaps emerging as the one to beat at the Oscars. We say that with all kinds of categories, I think, but... Yeah, he has certainly picked up a couple big recent precursors that might be indicating Paul Giamatti is going to win his first Oscar. We will certainly see in a few weeks. But right now, let's go ahead and get to my interview with the Holdover star and Best Actor nominee, Paul Giamatti. Paul Giamatti, thank you so much for joining us here on the Awardist podcast. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Well, so happy to have you here. Your work in this film, I mean, always, but this film is just, I mean, it is kind of next level. And we're certainly seeing that play out this award season. I saw you from a distance at the Oscar nominee luncheon. How was that for you, getting to catch up perhaps with some old friends, coworkers?
Sure,
even?
But also it was really nice to meet people. You know, I sat between a fellow who was nominated for sound and an animator who was nominated for an animated short. And it was kind of the coolest thing about that was meeting all of those people.
Yeah.
Was actually getting to talk to all these other people who do all this amazing stuff. And I never see them or meet them. And it was really
great.
Nice.
Yeah. Did you also get to meet the dog from Anatomy of a Fall? I must say.
I didn't know. I had no idea. Everybody was going on and on about the dog. I never saw the dog. I didn't even see the dog. I had no idea. That would have been amazing.
Oh, it was great. I think he was a little tired. You know, he had made the journey from France, so understandable. But he was a very good boy.
Oh, well, was he good? Because I would have, if I was a dog, I would have been like, "What is going on here?"
You know, 100%. Yeah, yeah. Well, as the season has gone, you have had the wonderful opportunity to take the stage a few times at various ceremonies. What is going through one's mind as you know it's your category. Some people have told me, they're like, I'm honestly just actually hoping they don't say my name because I hate being up on stage and that whole, you know, rigmarole. But what's it like for you?
I have that feeling often that, oh my God, I'm afraid to go up there because I'm too nervous. I've had that. And certainly, yes. But generally too, I just leave it to fate a lot of the time too. I try to have no expectation of anything if I can. I just don't know what's going to happen. You know, then it's, if it actually happens, my mind goes blank and I'm generally panicking because I'm trying to remember if I was smart enough to try to think of something to say, I'm trying to remember that. And then I'm trying to just not screw up too badly and say something bizarre. Or, you know, so it's just a panicky moment in a lot of ways.
No, but you've done well so far. I think you appropriately seized the opportunity with the whole In-N-Out Burger thing. And it was very funny and endearing. And I don't know if they have celebrity spokespeople, but I hope the offer comes your way.
That would be nice. Sure.
You know, that just made me think. They did, I suppose it was Focus Features, sent us gift cards after that whole thing happened.
Yes, I heard that. That was very kind of them. You know, you want to know something?
Really,
I don't think I got any of those gift cards.
Hey,
so
what?
I know, right?
Unbelievable. Oh, gosh. Well, yeah.
Really,
and
that's good. You use it. My God,
I'm going to. I will for sure. Great. And as timing would have it, David Hemmingson's script showed up today. So I love scripts.
Is the cover of it the Meditations cover from the...
It is. You're right.
Oh my God, that's very clever of them. That was really smart. It's beautiful. That's hilarious.
Yeah, that's great.
Smart.
Before we get into some specifics on the Holdovers, I want to ask you, because I was, you know, just doing my research and looking back on your career. Your very first award nomination, not just Oscar, but nomination on record that I can find, do you remember what it was?
No, I don't.
All right. I'll give you a little hint. It was for Favorite Supporting Actor. The year was 2001. It was for Big Mama's House at the Blockbuster Entertainment Awards.
Really? Holy cow. I had no idea. Wow. I don't think anybody ever even told me. Did I win? I didn't. Did I? I didn't get it. Did I?
When you
get,
I believe like, it was a nomination.
The popcorn thing? Was that the Blockbuster Award? Was that the Golden Popcorn? Or that's something else?
Is that the MTV Movie and TV Awards? Yeah, MTV's the, yeah.
Wow.
But there you go.
holy cow, blockbuster.
Yeah.
Holy
cow. What are your memories of that film?
A good time. It was a lot of fun, that thing, with shooting all the ridiculous party scenes. And one of my fondest memories of that, I have to say, is working briefly with Octavia Spencer, who then, you know, went on to great things. She's a tiny role in that movie. But I remember hanging out with her, and it was very funny. And that whole thing was just goofy and funny and ridiculous and silly. It was great.
Oh, well, here you are. Okay, so you were you're a graduate of Yale, a degree in English. At some point, were you ever perhaps going to be a Mr. Hunnam yourself? Because, of course, there are lots of possibilities with an English degree, but was teaching ever one of them?
Sure. I mean, I also come from a family of teachers. My parents and my grandparents, all of them are teachers. So there's always some sort of assumption that somebody's going to be a teacher. One of these kids, you know, and I have cousins who are teachers, and everybody's teachers. And so it went through my head, but really at bottom, some part of me knew I wanted to be an actor or something else, not a teacher. So I just didn't do it.
Yeah. Well, so then did you know people like Hunnam? Did he feel familiar in any way?
Oh, very much so. Yes. I went to a prep school like that only about 10 years after the movie is set. So I knew a lot of guys like that. They were still there. Those guys, and they were all guys, were still there, still teaching at those places. They were girls there now. So it was like, you know, there was that. But, and then my father had colleagues, my mother had colleagues, all these kinds of eccentric, especially my father's kind of eccentric academic colleagues at Yale University, very much informed a lot of what I did in this movie, for sure, for sure.
Well, you said deep down you knew that acting was somewhere in there, and you know, you did, of course, go to Yale School of Drama. Daveine Joy Randolph, also a graduate of that. When I spoke with her, she said, working with you, there was a familiarity that at first she was like, why do I feel like, you know, we're speaking the same language? And then she was like, wait, because we both went to Yale. She felt there was just a something that you guys were on the same wavelength and perhaps didn't even realize it.
We definitely were on the same wavelength. And it was one of those things that I enjoy when you're on a same wavelength with somebody and you don't even need to talk about it. She was one of those actors where we never talked about anything. We never talked about what on this scene do you think? Never, because it just was happening and we didn't need to. She says that. And I'm always like, maybe there was some similarity of technique we were taught, maybe. Yeah. She may be right about that. Yeah, but I tend to think it's just happenstance that we happen to be simpatico. You want me to get really woo-woo? We're both Geminis.
Oh.
I took it there. I went there. That's where I go with it. So that's what I'm going to say from now on. We're both Geminis, so we have similar characters. The stars faded it.
I was about to say the stars definitely aligned for that one. Yeah. Of course, reuniting with Alexander Payne, had you two been looking for something else to do together?
Yes.
Yeah.
We've been talking about doing stuff. Many years ago, we talked about doing a private eye thing, like a private investigator thing, which I still would love to do with him someday. And I was meant to be in the film Downsizing, but the budget became such that it was fiscally irresponsible to hire me. So they hired Mr. Matt Damon, which if you can't get me, you immediately go to Damon. Damon's phone rings when I turn something down. And then we tried to do this movie, actually, The Holdovers, a couple of years running, but the scheduling never worked out. And the schedule was very key to this because he wanted winter. He really wanted a real winter. So it never worked out until finally it did.
Okay. I got to ask about that whole fiscally irresponsible thing, because that's, that's of course, one of those. Yeah. It's a great phrase, but I have to suspect an obnoxious part of the business that one has to deal with.
Sure. I mean, you know, but it's not something. Sure, I suppose so. It's not, I'm nothing if not a very realistic human being, especially when it comes to the business. So, I mean, you know, I didn't come up with a lot of illusions about things. So I've never been surprised by those kinds of things. Like, you know, it would be fiscally irresponsible to put this guy in a $60 million movie or whatever it was. It made sense. It didn't surprise me. It's okay. Wow. It's all right. I went on to do other wonderful things, and I got to do this with Alexander.
Indeed. You know, that is true. There has to be a silver lining at some point, because passing on one thing means that other opportunities come your way. So yeah, great way of looking at that. Well, this character, I understand why you wanted to play him. I mean, you know, sometimes that word delicious gets thrown around with characters. And I feel like I see that here with that one, because there's so much you get to do with him. I'm curious, when you had your first chance to, you know, give this script a go, I'm curious if there was something that immediately stood out to you that you thought, ooh, this, I've never gotten to do this or that with any of my previous characters.
Well, you know, there was a sort of sweetness to the man that I really liked. There were moments that stood out for me. I remember reading them and thinking, I want to do this, because I haven't had a sort of moment. There's a lovely thing in this movie where I take the kid ice skating. That's my favorite thing in the movie. And it's inarticulate. And there's no words ever spoken. And I remembered reading it and thinking, that to me somehow is the heart of this thing. And I want to just do that. I want to do that part. I want to have that thing to do. You know, there was a funny thing with this character. I enjoy the kind of what I call kind of the Lon Chaney factor sometimes with characters. And I have to say the eye thing was interesting to me too. I thought, how are we going to do that? I've never done something like this. I'd really like to do something like this. And that actually was kind of strangely a very enjoyable part of playing this character.
Yeah, because that was all from David's script from the get-go, right?
It was. That was inspired, though, partially by a movie that Alexander saw, a French movie from the 30s called Merluz, which is a similar story. And in that story, the character also has a sort of condition with his eye. And so Alexander carried it over from that and sort of put it in the thing.
Got it. Okay. Now, I know it is certainly one thing physically to pull that off, which you have said that those contacts, it kind of made you blind in that eye?
Yeah, well, it did. It's an interesting, and it gives me an opportunity to actually credit this woman, Christina Patterson, who made the eye. And there's this incredible artist, and she hand paints these eyes. And this is what she does for television and film. And they're gorgeous. They're these little works of art. Apparently, my eye was particularly hard to match the color on, because my eyes change color on film. So she did a brilliant job. And so you get this thing, and yes, you put it over your whole eye, and I couldn't see out of that eye, which then became actually something very interesting for the character that he couldn't see, because he probably maybe couldn't see out of that eye. So it was actually an interesting sort of thing to then have to play with. It was really cool.
Yeah, I was going to ask how that physical aspect impacted whatever mental or emotional approach you might have had.
It does, because you know, all of these things make the man sort of feel outside, sort of acceptable to people, which, you know, it shouldn't be, but it places him outside those things. And so it sort of contributed something to him feeling, to my feeling, like, yes, I'm playing a guy who's not, you know, he's got things that make him different from other people. And he's dealt with those things by creating this armor around himself, this kind of persona that he's armored himself with. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it all contributes to that very much so.
Yeah. Well, right. Because in addition to the eye, and bear with me, I'm going to give this word a go. Yep. Trimethylaminuria.
That's pretty good. Trimethylaminuria. That was very good. Trimethylaminuria. Yes. It's an actual condition.
Yeah, I had never heard of it. And I feel like it's one of the things I remember as soon as I got out of the screening. I was like, what is this? Real thing?
It's a real thing, apparently. And I can't remember why it happens to people. But it's some lack of enzyme to break down something so that you can end up smelling like fish by the end of the day. It increases throughout the day. It's terrible.
That's terrible. That aspect particularly is fascinating.
It's another thing that he has to kind of worry about and sort of bury and hide and pretend that he's okay with and function in his life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned it kind of as an armor, because there were times when I was, before we even really knew about that aspect of his, you know, of his being, as you're watching the film, there were times I wondered, like, does he not like himself, or is there other trauma that has kind of conditioned him to even perhaps, you know, put up a guard to people about, you know, not necessarily wanting to get close. And of course, as, you know, the layers of the onion peel back, I think you kind of learn that it's a bit of both.
It is a bit of both. I think he's got a little bit of sort of self-loathing, but but not a ton. I mean, I think that it's an interesting character. You know, he's come to a point in his life where he has shut down a lot of, I mean, she says to him, you can't even dream a dream, you know, and he's, and it's that kind of person who's reached this point of truly believing that they no longer have aspirations to certain things and that certain things, you know, won't happen for them. That kind of resignation in a person is intense, you know, he's lost the sort of, I mean, he doesn't even know how much he wants to connect anymore. He's not even aware of it anymore. And it's like, that's kind of an amazing place to be. It's sad. And it's an interesting thing to play. You know, when that woman, when he sees that Carrie Preston's character has a boyfriend, it's not so much that he says to himself, oh gosh, that's not going to work out. Oh gosh, I really liked her. Maybe she liked me. He says, you're a fool to himself. Why did you ever even think that was happening, going to happen for you? Of course it's not. You knew that, and why did you put yourself in this position? It's that that he feels that's actually really painful, because he doesn't even, the sense that he could even aspire to, it's not even there anymore. Right. It's like, you know, that's sad.
Oh, I, as an audience member, that happens. And I remember I smacked the arm of my chair. Ursula was like, oh, no. But because then there was the moment before, right? There was the moment before that with the mistletoe and everything. I was like, oh, yeah, are you kidding me?
Oh, maybe she is. I know. You know, maybe she is. No, she just kind of pities the guy. She kind of takes pity on him because he's such an outsider, and she's a sweet woman, and she wants him to feel like he belongs.
Such a sweet woman. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned sad is a word you used, but I will also say, you know, below the surface and eventually above the surface, the story is, it's also just really beautiful. You know, as we kind of get to certain places with each of these characters, but I also think so much of that, of course, it's all there in the script, but I really do firmly believe so much of it relies on you and Davine and Dominic Sessa, who just, fantastic performance. Yeah.
He's amazing. So is she. And then they both are. But he amazes me because he's never done anything before.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a position like that, working with someone, their very first film, but it also be such a large role like that?
No, I don't think so. No. I've never had to be in that position, but you wouldn't have known it. I mean, his level of seriousness and professionalism was astonishing. I mean, it was like he was on point, and he's a lovely guy, and he was a pleasure to be around. And in some ways, Davine and I were talking about this. In some ways, we kind of followed his lead a little bit because he was so, that kind of beginner's mind thing. We both just sort of were like, "You're amazing. It's lovely to be around you." You know, his patience and his thoughtfulness, it kind of guided us a little bit.
Right.
I'm not kidding. He was amazing to be around. Wonderful.
Well, and of course, so much of the action of the story is their reaction to him.
Yes.
So he's
what it's really about. You know, he's the kid who carries any promise of sort of what life could be. You know what I mean? She's where she is, and I'm where I am. Yep. She's in the middle. She's probably going to be okay. Who knows? But he's got all the promise. He's got all the possibility. You know, so it's like, so you really are kind of focused on him. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned that, you know, you and Davine didn't really have to talk about, you know, or think about what are we going to do here. But on the flip side of that, were there moments perhaps at all where, maybe you didn't talk much about how a scene would go, but once the scene was done, cut was called, was there ever a communal feeling sense like, oh, we got exactly what was needed for the intent of that scene?
Yeah, I think it happened a lot on this. I definitely think of that with the TV watching scenes, especially the first one when she and I are watching The Newlyweds, which was a wonderful scene to shoot, something I was really looking forward to shooting. And I loved just that whole feel of two people alone in this vast place, with the TV flickering in their faces kind of thing. But it was also that scene really nailed it. You know, something that felt so wonderful, and it was one of the last things we shot, and it felt so great, was the fun, lovely moment in the end when they're watching the ball drop for New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And they toast each other and they go in the, God, I'm getting all choked up just thinking about it. And they go in the kitchen and light off the firework. Yeah. And there was something about that. And knowing that they were shooting, he was shooting outside the window. Mm-hmm. And I remember just thinking, this is absolutely such a beautiful, real, believable, true moment right now. And we're getting it. I think we're getting it right. And yeah. I thought, what a beautiful thing to kind of come to. Not quite the end of the movie, but the mm-hmm. but the it's the happy ending of the movie that the movie doesn't entirely end with.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I love that too. The way you said that that's shot outside, and you like you get a bit of the boom, yeah. and you see the Vina flinch and grab their ears, but you don't know what they say after that.
Yeah, and I loved it that he chose that you're observing it from outside the window. It's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's just something so beautiful about it. It's really great.
Yeah. And also from your perspective, I have to imagine there's a certain level of joy that comes with delivering lines like you are and always have been penis cancer in human form.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that the language of this thing was so – now, delicious is a word that applies. When you said that, I was like, well, the language was because it was literally like eating lovely sort of Turkish delight kind of things, you know, and it was – so all of that kind of Baroque put downs and stuff like that were really great. And it's funny to me how it all just ends with really crass penis cancer. After all these kind of erudite insults, I finally just land on you're a dick, basically. You know, and it's like very funny. And I now it's a good parting shot too. You know, you feel like the guy gets off a good parting shot to those people.
Yeah. Did you know when filming it, like how Alexander was going to that feel of it being a film, of course, set in the 70s, but a film made in the 70s. I mean, I'm even thinking about, you know, when the movie trailer came out, there was, you know, the voice of God, the announcer in that, which we just don't have anymore. And it just felt, you know, that complete package. How much did he tell you guys about that going in?
Apparently he saw like 50 guys to find that voice, to finally find that right voice. He found exactly that voice that sounded like the 70s announcer voiceover guy. Yeah, we were aware of it. I mean, you know, I was aware that he was going to be shooting it differently than, say, Sideways, that it was going to be shot much more formally than and simply like a 70s movie, where Sideways there was more two-camera stuff and stuff like that. And so we could sort of – and I also knew the sound. The guy who did – Dave Schwartz, the sound engineer, the guy who was running the sound for the movie, I knew he was going to be recording it mono. Which he was sort of excited about because he was like, so we knew that all this stuff was going to be in place. Yeah. And then I know that he, especially with Dom, he screened some 70s movies for him to give him sort of the feel of it and stuff. So we're all very aware of it being the idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's just, it is one of my absolute favorites, certainly of this year, but I would say even of recent years. You know, it's one of those movies I went in not really knowing what I was going to get, and I came out just, I couldn't tell enough people, you know, that they must watch. So awesome. Congratulations on that and all the work here. Last thing I got to ask, have you, since that interview with Stern, have you heard from Cher again?
She doesn't call me. She called me once and I called her back and then it's radio silence ever since. Mm. Someday it's
going to
happen.
Guess who's joining us on the line right now? No, I'm kidding.
That would be so great. Oh, my God. That would be awesome.
Look, I was tempted to reach out and make that happen, but maybe you'll run into each other somewhere.
Well, now she's just being harassed by me. I'm sure. Terrible. Now I'm just harassing her.
Right. Oh, well, we got to make that phone call happen. We need to know what's going on. Yeah. Well, Paul, again, congrats and thank you so much for your time and enjoy the rest of award season.
I will, man. Thank you very much.
Well, I kind of mentioned it there. We talked about it a bit earlier, Lauren. You know, how much I love the film, but his performance is just, I think, one of the best I have seen in so many years because, to elaborate on why I think so, just because of how much he gets to do with this character. Like he was saying there, it's a sad guy, but you know, like there's potential there and there's something, and he's a little self-loathing, but you can see it in him that he,
you know, he believes in people. He wants people to, you know, achieve great things. It's just his delivery is not the best. Paul's delivery is great. The, you know, Mr. Hunnam's is not the best. The other Paul. So yeah, it's an interesting tightrope to walk there. But he also just has some really great lines too. But do you think
insults I've seen on screen?
Oh my gosh!
In a long
yes,
time.
Yes, exactly. That's why I had to bring up that you are penis cancer in human form. It's it's such a great line. So good.
Perfect. No notes.
Yeah. Yeah. But all that said, do you feel like it's Paul's, or do you think there is still really strong competition from Killian that he could get in there for Oppenheimer, Killian Murphy?
I mean, listen, you know what I always say with these types of things is like, never say never. I mean, it's all possible. Technically, if you're nominated, there is always a chance. And I do think it is between Killian and Paul. I would be completely shocked if it wasn't one of those two. But I mean, listen, we all know Oppenheimer clearly has so much support. I mean, it got 13 nominations. It's huge. It's winning a lot already. Important precursors and whatnot. I will be very curious to see what SAG does with this one. Killian is wonderful, and he's also another one that just like consistently gives amazing performances, and people just seem to just like
pass him by.
So you know, I could see it. I do kind of feel like this is Paul's year, though. I think that there is definitely a little bit of that aspect of a little bit of like what we saw with Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant a few years back, where it's like, all right, this is this man's time.
Right.
It's one of those performances, I think, because of sort of what you were talking about with lines like the penis cancer and things. Like there's so much in this character that is lovable in different ways, and it speaks to so many different things that I feel like with Oppenheimer, it's almost a more subdued performance because of who Oppenheimer was and how he conducted himself in a lot of places, and that film is quite long, so there's a lot there too, but I don't know, I feel like Paul's performance is the type that people can really get behind for a lot of reasons. If you like the comedy, it's got the comedy. If you like the sad guy winter, you got the sad guy winter.
That's a great point.
It speaks to all of it. What do you think?
Yeah. I think I'm with you on that. I'm typically one who I get upset when the showy performance wins. And there's one that's just so great and subtle and, you know, just a lot of thought and a lot beneath the surface and all of that kind of stuff. And I think, you know, Killian does that in so many ways, but while Paul's is a showier performance, I think it's an incredible performance, and there's so much to it. There's so many layers to this guy. I think layers that perhaps aren't even necessarily in David Hemmingson's script, because as Paul told us there, you know, he comes from a long line of teachers and he knows people like this guy. And so I think he was able to, weave all, you know, those kinds of people into the fabric of who this guy is. And so you just felt even if you've never had a professor or a teacher like him, you can just imagine that there are people like him.
And it's a very lived-in type of performance.
Lived-in and authentic.
I had a teacher like that, by the way.
Oh, boy.
Which is probably why I just adore everything about that film and his performance, because I totally had a professor like that.
Yeah. See, there you go.
A lot
people
of people probably
will relate.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Well, he is fantastic. By the way, if you have not seen The Holdovers, it is available to stream on Peacock or to rent or buy on digital platforms. Oh, and by the way, to your point, Lauren, about SAG Awards, those happen before Oscar voting is over. So it certainly can have impact. If someone gets up there and gives an absolutely wretched speech, something like that happens, you know, it can go one way or the other. It can boost you or it can kill your chances. So those SAG Awards coming up next weekend are very important. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll be watching very carefully.
Oh, I know. Streaming on Netflix for the first time ever. It'll be odd, but we'll see how it goes. Yeah. Well, Lauren, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Always love being here. Of course.
Well, happy to have you. And thanks so much to all of you for listening. If you like what you're hearing here on The Awardist, follow, rate the podcast, and leave us an award-winning review on Apple Podcasts. And to keep the conversation with us going, you can follow Entertainment Weekly on all socials. We're at EW on X, formerly known as Twitter, and at Entertainment Weekly everywhere else. You can also tag me at Jared Hall. We'll see you back here next week and every day at EW.com. This episode of The Awardist is hosted and produced by Jared Hall and produced and edited by Sammy Junio. Full episode transcripts are available at EW.com. Thanks for listening.